right. So thanks a lot. And I want to start off, of course, by thanking the organizers for this workshop and the conference, even though we heard this morning from Lars that it's really not very much work at all to organize. So what I want to talk about today is joint work with Jan Troost over a series of papers in a couple of years. So let me start out just by way of general motivation. So this project started with the AGT conjecture, which dates back almost a decade now, and is a theorem to a certain extent for parts of it. And the AGT conjecture relates conformal blocks to the Nekrasov partition function of n equals 2 gauge theories. Now we just heard a lot about the Nekrasov partition function, and I'll review some very basic things about it in a second. But so my interest in the Nekrasov partition function mainly is related to this axis over here, where one can think of it as a limit of the topological string partition function. And of course, the topological string, one can think of, well, it's many things, but it's also a toy model for string theory. So on this green side, or it looks slightly bluish over here, I've written target space. And by that, I mean from sort of the parent string theory, what you would get if you had something like a string field theory to calculate the partition function of. And now on the right-hand side, I wrote worldsheet, because here you look at some expansion, some sort of semi-classical expansion maybe of the partition function. And these coefficients over here in string theory would be what you calculate from the worldsheet genus by genus. Okay? And so why I care about the Nekrasov partition function is because it provides a simple the simplest instance of this relation between a target space quantity here and a worldsheet quantity on the right-hand side. The simplest instance, because this squiggle, in some cases, is just an asymptotic expansion. And so the hope is that by studying this, we'll understand more about target space worldsheet duality. And so a lot of this was known before AGT, and the hope was that since AGT offers us a new vantage point on the Nekrasov partition function, it'll offer new tools to study this relation and then maybe get something out of it for this relation down here. And that new tool turns out to be WKB analysis, and that's basically the content of my talk. What does WKB analysis teach us about the left and the right-hand side? So here's the outline. So I'll start with a very quick review about n equals 2 gauge theory and Z-Nekrasov. Now, for those of you who followed Sasha's nice review right now, this will be way too basic. But if you aren't familiar with these terms at all, then this is for you. And this is just one or two slides, so everybody else should not leave the room. So I'll also say how AGT yields WKB as a tool to study the Nekrasov partition function. And then starts the real part of my talk. I'll talk about three things. The first is, how does WKB allow us to reproduce results that we can compute in other ways, for example, using the holomorphic anomaly equations, and gives rise to sort of a nice math puzzle that I will explain to you. The second part, quantum geometry, deals with the question, is there a nice way of defining quantum geometry, I guess generally, and the answer will be that in WKB there's a very precise thing you can mean by quantum geometry. And then finally I'll talk about how exact WKB methods can teach us something about this relation between the worldsheet and the target space view of these quantities. And here Masahito already did a very nice job of explaining some of the concepts that I will need. Okay, so off we go. The sort of important thing you need to understand if you don't know what n equals 2 supersymmetric gauge theories are is that they're quantum field theories that come in families. Now, quantum field theories come in families in two ways. Either you have some marginal direction and that parametrizes the family, or what's going to be relevant here, you have a vacuum manifold. You have a vacuum manifold parametrized by VEVs of a scalar field. And the reason that that happens in n equals 2 supersymmetric gauge theories is that you have a gauge field, a spin 1 particle, and that always has a supersymmetric partner, which is a scalar. So you see that here, each supersymmetry generator increases the spin by 1/2. So you have 1/2 here over there acting by one or the other supersymmetry generator, and acting by both, you connect the gauge field to a scalar. So that's the first thing you need in order to have a family. And the second is that you need to have flat directions and the potential for that scalar, so that whatever value on that in that valley that the scalar field takes corresponds to a vacuum of your theory. And that's guaranteed by n equals 2 symmetry. So that's the reason behind the existence of families. And now n equals 2 theories at a level of, well, if it's a little bit old-fashioned, but if we talk about the Lagrangian, they're completely determined at two derivative level by this quantity that Sasha introduced, which is the prepotential, which we can think of as a function either of A, of the vacuum expectation value, or of the whole scalar field, phi. And if we think of it as a function of the scalar field, it, for example, determines the gauge kinetic coupling of the theory. Now, if you fix F0 to be something very simple in the UV, then it'll obtain corrections in the effective theory. Not very many perturbative corrections, but it will obtain instanton corrections. And so the name of the game 20 years ago was how to compute those corrections. So Seiberg-Witten solved that problem in a very nice way. They mapped the family of conformal field theories to a family of tori, which encode the prepotential. So I've depicted that over here. Here is the moduli space of the theory, and here are tori over each point. And they're fatter and thinner. That's supposed to indicate the different complex structure. And with Seiberg and Witten, one of the outcomes of their analysis is that this vacuum expectation value A is only regionally in moduli space, locally, a good parameter. But they did find a global good parameter, which is called U, and A appears as the period of a meromorphic one-form which comes as part of the Seiberg-Witten data, okay? And so this lambda, as a function of U, will play an important role in this talk. So since we're on a torus, we have two independent cycles. A comes as the period of along one cycle, the A cycle, and then the period along the second cycle allows us to determine F0. Okay. So here are some examples. Sasha already introduced pure SU2, which is the case without any hypers. It's the simplest case and the case that was treated in the first Seiberg-Witten paper. And so here very clearly we see the elliptic curve, right? And then the other two cases that I want to consider are n equals 2 star and nf equals 4, which Sasha also talked about, which are superconformal in the massless limit. So the difference between these theories is that here we have a scale, which is the second parameter that the Seiberg-Witten curve depends on, and the dependence on that is simple because it's fixed by dimensional analysis. Down here, we don't have a scale because these theories become superconformal, but we have some marginal coupling tau, and the dependence on that is much more complicated. Also, the way I've written the curves over here, they're actually not genus 1, but genus 2, because here we have the Weierstrass P function, which lives on a torus, and then this equation defines the double cover of that torus. But that's a little bit of an artifact of how I've chosen to write the functions, because this is the most compact way of writing them. In the Seiberg-Witten papers, they gave genus 1 curves for these gauge theories. Okay. So now the Nekrasov partition function is a second way of calculating the prepotential, even though it turns out to be so much more. So as introduced in the previous talk, it's a generating function for equivariant integrals over moduli space of instantons. These parameters epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 were introduced cleverly by Nekrasov to help localize this integral to points. Okay, so they're equivariant parameters which act as rotations on orthogonal planes in space-time. Now, the relation between Z-Nekrasov and the prepotential is that if you expand Z-Nekrasov here in epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, where I've organized the sum in terms of this product and that sum, then you reproduce F0, the prepotential, as the leading term, the 1 over epsilon 1, epsilon 2 term in this sum. Okay, and so like I said in the motivational on the motivational slide, this squiggle is what we want to understand better. Okay, so I motivated this analysis talking about string theory, but there is an important difference, which is that in gauge theory, this, at least for large A, converges. So we have a good chance of understanding this relation by thinking of this as an asymptotic expansion in terms of the exponential of a power series to this side. In topological string theory, both sides are formal power series, one of them in Q, which was the instanton counting parameter. And I forgot to mention that the instanton counting parameter maps either to lambda, the scale, or to some function of tau, which was the marginal coupling. So in topological string theory, this is a formal power series in Q and the right-hand side in G string and S. And the hope is that you have some underlying object which has both of these asymptotic expansions. Okay. And so the last thing I need is to get to WEKB is the AGT correspondence. So it relates Z-Nekrasov to conformal blocks. And here I've written the dictionary between the epsilon parameters and some of the CFT parameters, which we will need to know in detail. The thing that's important is this bottom line, which I will reproduce on the next slide, which tells us that if we look at something slightly more complicated than Z-Nekrasov, if we introduce also a surface operator, then that maps to conformal blocks with degenerate insertions, which Jared talked about this morning, which are seemingly more complicated objects, but in fact, the degenerate insertion allows us to write differential equations for them. So I will denote these objects as psi z tau, where tau, together with epsilon, et cetera, are all the previous parameters. And z is the additional parameter that enters when we consider these surface operators or the degenerate insertions. So, for example, on the CFT side, it would be the location of the degenerate insertion. Okay. So the differential equation, which will become the WKB equation, is the null vector decoupling equation for psi z tau. Now, in fact, the full correlator satisfies the null vector decoupling equation. To project out onto a conformal block, we impose on the differential equation a monodromy condition in Z, and that's where the A dependence enters. Remember, A was the quantity that was parameterizing the VEVs. Okay. So here are some examples of null vector decoupling equations. And you already see the form of WKB, which Masioto had on the board today, appearing over here, except that we also have a derivative with regard to the second parameter on which psi depends. So that, in itself, we could try to solve that. But if you remember, we wanted to understand Z-Nekrasov, but instead we introduced an object which is more complicated. So if our goal remains to study the Z-Nekrasov, then we need to somehow be able to decouple the effects of the degenerate insertion. And that's possible in this epsilon 2 to 0 limit, which Sasha introduced at the Nekrasov-Shatashvili limit. So if we want to use null vector decoupling to understand Nekrasov, then we must take this limit. Which then allows us to identify the part that just gives Z-Nekrasov and the additional contribution due to the insertion. Okay, but note that by taking epsilon 2 to 0, we're taking epsilon 1 times epsilon 2 to 0, and that's the original string, the parameter that maps to the genus counting parameter in string theory. So that's an unfortunate thing because that's really what we wanted to understand, the sort of this additional deformation in the S direction. I had two parameters, G string and S, was a little bit of an afterthought. It was right, string theory starts out as a genus expansion. So that's life. In effect, I mean, it is what it is. It tells you that the genus expansion is actually something more complicated than the S deformation of the theory. But sort of to pay penance, I'll keep the 1 index for a while. I won't just call the deformation parameter epsilon to remind us that we don't have any control over the full deformation of the theory. So that was my review, which took a little bit longer than I had hoped. So now I want to first show you how WKB allows you to do computations in a very nice way for, and I'll do this for the example of n equals 2 star. So here's the null vector decoupling equation again. We'll plug in our ansatz in the Nekrasov-Shvatashvili limit epsilon 2 to 0, and we get, it gives rise to this equation. So notice that the second derivative that we were worried about, which made things a little bit more complicated, is now just encoded in this function. So for the rest of this analysis, we could just call this u, okay? So there's no second derivative there. This is just a differential equation in the parameter z. But we will use it both to determine w prime and this d tau of f, okay? And the way we do that is that we look at the expansion, you know, as is common in WKB in terms of epsilon, and we impose also the boundary condition. So here's how the individual equations look if you go order by order. So this won't be on the exam. But notice that the boundary conditions are just tell you the WZ prime is something, and the A period of all the other WI primes is zero. Okay, and that gives rise to a very nice structure. So I just want to go through this because usually if you've done WKB, it's a pain. And in the case of massless, so n equals 2 star, which is n equals 4, perhaps not surprisingly because n equals 4 is a very nice theory, it's fun to go through the analysis. And the reason that it becomes so simple is that this equation, remember on the right-hand side you have f0, which doesn't depend on z, which was the insertion point for this degenerate operator. This tells you that w prime is just constant. So this integral over A, which it was the boundary condition, you can pull it through WZ prime, which allows you to just determine WZ prime by the boundary condition, and you plug that in to get F0. And from that point forth, the structure is that you have the new WN prime that you want to solve for. Remember, you're doing something recursively. Appears in this form, WZ prime is a constant, and the boundary condition on W2 prime was that the A cycle integral vanishes. So you integrate your equation over the A cycle. This vanishes, so you can use the rest just to determine the Fn, and then you plug that back in to determine W, okay? And so you see from here that you get F2 and then all of the higher Fn's as A cycle integrals over the powers of the Weierstrass-P function, and that's just this result over here gives you an element in the ring of quasi-modular forms. Okay, so that's how modularity is arising in this context for d tau of Fn and for the Wn primes. Okay, so it's not too surprising that we get modularity. Everything was on a torus. Our quantities are modular. But what is surprising is that what we're interested in is not just d tau, but the integral of that, right? We want to get fn, not d tau of fn. Now, quasi-modular forms aren't closed under integration. So if you take a quasi-modular form and you integrate it, you don't necessarily, or you don't generically get a quasi-modular form. In fact, you get constraints on the coefficients so that you do get a quasi-modular form from the Ramanujan relations. And those are kind of complicated to solve. And yet, it turns out to be true that for all of the Fn's, if you integrate them, you again get a quasi-modular form, okay? Now, if you look at just this set of equations and you try to find why that's real, like perhaps you want to solve the algebraic constraints coming from the Ramanujan equations, that turns out to be very, very hard. So you can try giving that to your mathematician friend and ask him to solve it. So we did that with Dan Zagier. And he was interested enough to actually put this on Mathematica and confirm the fact that it's true, but he didn't come up, I think he wasn't interested enough to actually then try to solve it, but let's put it that way. Okay, so we put the problem aside to think about other things, but it turns out that in thinking about other things, we actually find a solution to this problem in kind of a cute way. Okay, so quantum geometry, the second thing I want to use WKB for. In this context, it's basically the question, can we extend the Cyrab-Witten framework, the geometrization of the problem, to apply also to these quantum deformed contributions to the prepotential, to Fn? Okay, so basically we want to find an epsilon-dependent meromorphic one-form whose periods give us Fn in just the same way as happens for the leading contribution. Okay, and now in this WKB formalism, there's a very natural candidate for lambda, which is W prime. The reason for that is because the leading contribution to W prime just gives you the Cyber-Gwynne differential. So it seems natural to write the rest of it. So what I've done over here is I've just solved the WKV equation for W prime. So notice the structure of this is not a new way of computing W prime. This contains exactly the same information as this equation over here, because W double prime appears on the right-hand side. But it does give you a definition of lambda as a formal power series. Okay, so now you can look at this definition and see if it satisfies your idea of what we wanted quantum geometry to be. So here we define a capital U as the tau derivative of F. And just as I showed you, the dependence of capital U on A and epsilon follows by this boundary condition. And now we could show, and I don't have time to go through that at all, but using the Riemann bilinear identity, we could show that indeed this quantum geometry relation is true, so that the tau derivative of AD does indeed give you, so if you just go up one tau derivative, you see that AD does give you DF DA. Okay, so that's what we wanted to see. So basically, you're getting this epsilon deformation, you've embedded it into the geometry. And how does that help us with our quasi-modularity problem? Well, this gives us a second way of writing F. Now we get dF dA as this integral over the epsilon deformed lambda. And this is manifestly quasi-modular because you only have P and the Eisenstein series appearing over there. And this A derivative, unlike the tau derivative, doesn't bother you. It doesn't interfere with the fact that you have quasi-modularity. Okay. So finally, I want to get to the question of exact WKV. So far, we've been only playing with formal power series in epsilon, and the question is, can we go beyond that? Okay, so first, here's an argument. How do we even know that these are formal power series? Maybe they actually converge, and we can go home, if that's the problem that we wanted to solve. And a quick argument why they can't converge is the following. So we just saw that you can write, I write Z top there, but it could just be Z Neprasov. We have the sum over quasi-modular forms times epsilon, some powers of epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And so here, notice I'm going away from the Neprasov-Shvatashvili limit because this is the one result that I'll present today, which is valid in general. So these quasi-modular forms appear also for arbitrary G. You show that not using WKV, but using holomorphic anomaly, for example. Okay, so this is a perfectly convergent, absolutely convergent power series. Now let's assume that the whole thing is convergent. Okay, that's what we want to show is not true, but let's assume it is. So if it is, then it's a power series, so we can invert the order of summation, and we first sum over epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, and then over powers of Q. But here, from Neprasov or from conformal blocks, we know what form these sums have. They're a rational function, epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, but such that the coefficients depend on n and increase with n. So if the convergence radius here was delta n, since these coefficients of epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 increase with n, we know that the radius of convergence goes to 0 as n increases. So that tells us that the original assumption was wrong and that cannot possibly converge. Okay, so if it doesn't converge, is there some analytic object that we can define that does converge to that? And I think henceforth I've paid penance, I'm going to drop the one on the epsilon. Okay, so this is exactly the same system that Sasha studied. It's pure SU2 or the Mathieu equation. He had this equation on his slides as well. So here I just indicated quickly we're kind of a far way when we look at this parameterization from the torus. Right, so here is the torus as we understand it well, a two-cut plane. And here I've mapped how in this Q-plane we're parameterizing the same region. So sort of this entire geometry is folded up into an infinite rectangle, and then you have infinite copies of that. And that's on the upper half-plane. In the lower half-plane you have the second sheet. Okay, and in particular the A cycle over here, which goes around like that, here corresponds to shifting Q by 2 pi. Okay. So we have a differential equation that we want to solve. It has a periodic potential, so Floquet theory applies. And what that tells you is that the solution has this general form. There is some periodic part, and then the non-periodic part can be written in terms of this exponential, where the coefficients nu minus and plus are called characteristic exponents, and for this type of potential, they actually satisfy this relation. Okay, and so because this is periodic, shifting q by 2 pi, the effect is captured in the characteristic exponent. So it seems natural to then identify what we mean by A, which remember determined the monodromy in the case of the double KV solution. If there is some exact notion of A, not just as a form of power series, to identify that with the characteristic exponent. So our strategy is going to be the following: to determine the monodromy of the differential equation using exact WKB methods. So that's going to have this form if we take the trace. Then we want to, and that's how we're defining what we mean by A exact. Then A exact depends on the parameters of the differential equation, which are U and epsilon. We'll invert this relation to get U exact in terms of A and epsilon, and then we'll use the general, the generalized Matona relation or the quantum Matona relation to determine F exact. Okay, that's the strategy. This part is going to work out, this first part is going to work out nicely, the rest, not so much to date. Okay, so in 2 seconds, Borel transform. What that does for you is if you have a series which doesn't converge, you replace it by something that does, but that's not what you care about. So you you go from this convergent power series, you do the inverse Borel transform, which involves choosing, so here is psi b, and it's an integral over a ray in the y-plane. Okay, so it involves making that choice, and then two things will, several things can happen. If the integral in the direction theta exists, then the quantity that you've defined, which is analytic, up to analytic complications, is going to have the asymptotic power series, the power series that you started with, the formal power series, as its asymptotic power series. If, on the other hand, the integral doesn't converge, but if you wiggle theta slightly, you do get something convergent, then you'll get two functions, both of which have psi epsilon as an asymptotic expansion. So by that fact, since this is a formal power series, it means that these two functions have to differ by something that's exponentially suppressed, since they have the same since they have the same formal power series as their asymptotic limit. Okay, so these theta singulars, where the second thing happens, they divide the y-plane into so-called Stokes sectors, which Masahito talked about this morning, and he also introduced the Stokes regions. That's what happens when your formal power series depends on a second parameter q. So what that means is that these thetas on which for which the Stokes the inverse Laplace transform doesn't converge, these thetas will depend on q. Okay. So now if you keep q fixed, but you vary q, then you'll have certain lines where your theta singular q coincides with the theta that you're keeping fixed. So when you cross those lines, bad things or interesting things can happen. That's exactly when you're going from one y sector into another y sector. Okay, and this Masahito to explain in more detail than I will. These you can get these Stokes lines by some formalism, where you see that the Stoke lines emanate from so-called turning points, which are the zero points of the potential. So for this problem, unlike the problems that he was looking at, it's not too difficult to get this type of diagram. So here you see the q-plane. I've chosen this particular fixed theta equals zero. And on each of these lines, theta singular q coincides with theta zero. Okay. So then you go ahead and solve your equation via WKB ansatz. So I've just written a couple of the solutions of the first couple of orders there. And it turns out that if you massage the terms in the right way, so this is the sum over all odd contributions and this over all even contributions, you can write the WKB sum in this way. Okay, and so this is the starting point for the exact WKB analysis. Notice that you have a choice of normalization since it's a differential equation, and that here is going to boil down to fixing the lower boundary, and that's going to play an important role in a second. Okay, so what we're going to use to determine the monodromy is is exactly this fact that interesting things happen when you cross Stokes lines. So the interesting thing that happens is that if you resum the WKD solutions in some Stokes region, and then you analytically continue to another Stokes region, you don't get the same thing, generically, as if you start in the second Stokes region and just directly resum over there. So that's this jumping phenomenon. Okay. So the basis of solutions to your differential equation is second order, so you have a two-dimensional basis, which you get by resumming the WKV solutions. They are related in a simple way to each other as you go from one region to the next, which, for example, here shows you that. So what this S does is it relates one basis to the other, and you see that you sum one contribution, which is also something Masahito talked about. You have one plus the other, and the other one stays put. So this nice transformation property happens when the WKV solutions are normalized in an appropriate way. And the appropriate normalization is that they're normalized at the turning point. That means that you choose as the bottom value for this integral, a turning point, the value at the QI, which is a turning point, but the turning point which from which the Stokes line emanates that you're crossing. Okay, so if you're crossing one Stokes line and then another, you have to change the normalization of your WKV solution if you want it to transform nicely in both cases. Okay, and so what is that change in normalization? Well, you need to change this QI from Q1 to Q2, and that's exactly where the Boris symbol or Boris multiplier enters that Masahito talked about. So here in this somewhat overloaded notation, Q1 and Q2 indicate this function normalized at Q1 or normalized at Q2. And this tells you in which Stokes region you've performed the resummation. This is resummed in region I. And this is the matrix that relates the two normalizations. This S down here is, remember, when to do the Borel resummation, we had to fix a theta. And that's what that is telling you. Okay, so having set all that up, we're ready to determine our monodromy by moving from Q plus 2 pi to Q. Every time we cross a Stokes line, we have to make sure that our function is properly normalized. If not, we change the normalization, and then we can use these connection matrices to relate the different bases. Okay, so we get this. Now, using the fact that if we replace the argument plus 2 pi everywhere by just argument, then we get this equality. We finally arrive at the form of our the form we need to read off the monodromy matrix, which is just this combination of S's and N's. Remember, the S's were the connection matrix and N was the change of normalization. And so this gives a very nifty result. So there it is. That's the monodromy matrix, the trace of the monodromy matrix, where this A is the Boris multiplier for the A cycle that I introduced in my first slide of this section. Now, what's surprising over here, which I have to go over a little bit quickly, is the fact that we have sector dependence, because trace M is a property of the differential equation, and as such, it shouldn't care about in which sector I perform my analysis, So this apparent sector dependence goes away if you take into account the jumping behavior of Boris multipliers or Boris symbols, which is this relation, which Masahito introduced to also define cluster algebras. So if you use this relation in this equation up here, you see that this N dependence actually goes away. Okay, so. Okay, so that part's good. That's the part that we like. Now, the next step is to invert this relation. So here's this is the trace of M again. And now we want to invert this to write A exact as a function of U and epsilon, and then use that to get at F exact. And so the only idea we had was to make some trans series ansatz for A in terms of A exact and just go through the mess. And we get some result for F. Now, maybe we had run out of steam at this point, but we couldn't really get a systematics for what the trans series coefficients look like. And so that's where the story stands. But as I learned from Marcus, there's interesting new results coming out about exactly this problem, or a similar problem soon. Okay, so with a little bit of 5 minutes late, I'm coming to my conclusions in opposite order to the order in which I presented them. So first we see that exact WKB takes us some ways towards controlling the semi-classical expansion, which appears on the right-hand side, the world sheet side, of this relation between Zinnekrasov and the exponential. But still, the computation with trans series needs to be better controlled if we really want to get some handy result that that teaches us something. I also talked about how WKB offers a systematic approach to what you could call quantum geometry in this context, geometrizing the epsilon deformation, but only in the NS limit. And along the way, there's some fun to be had with quasi-modularity and this sort of thing. So thanks a lot.
Okay, let's thank the speaker. We have a few minutes. Please, questions, comments?
Yes, please.
Well, I'm embarrassed that since you quoted me for the proper normalization of WKB solutions, I would like to mention that in the case of the polynomial potentials, I considerably changed my mind and I found out that it's much, much simpler to put this normalization point at infinity and not move it.
But what does that give you for the S's, for the connection matrices?
Well, it still works, but you don't have to constantly change the normalization of your WKB solution.
But then surely the connection matrices must depend on the A's.
Well,
on the...
yes.
Right,
yes.
So, okay.
But I did it for the polynomial, so I'm very interested what can be done in your case, which is not polynomial.
Right, which is a cosine.
Okay, thank you. More questions or comments? Okay, I don't see questions or comments. I guess people are tired and the bus soon will come to take people to the hotel. So let's thank the speaker again. We stop at this point and resume tomorrow at 9 o'clock.